We'll begin with the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of Theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the Theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of Theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among Theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among Theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards, as Theosophists, all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true Theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. In keeping with this policy, here in Philadelphia, we have two weekly meetings to be found, of course, on this schedule. This Sunday morning one, which is from 11 to 12, the doors opening at 10:30, and our overall subject for the month of January is Keys to Spiritual Growth. Next Sunday, January 24th, the title is The Keys of Truthfulness and Sincerity. On Wednesdays, we have a reference library that opens at 5:15 and closes at 7:15, just before our study class, which is from 7:30 to 8:30. We're studying The Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge. In both meetings, there is ample time for question and discussion, and our book table is open before and after meetings in order for you to purchase straight-line theosophical literature. But we remind everyone that if you go on the Phoenix ULT website, most of that literature is there online, and it is scannable and searchable by even just a word. So it's a wonderful resource. The work that is done here, or any ULT, is done on the basis of voluntary donations of time, of service, of energy, but especially in this day and age, of money. We have no fees or dues. We don't pass the hat. We rely totally upon donations. And everyone should realize small donations from many people add up to a big donation. So don't hesitate to give because you feel you can't give enough. That's our point. In line with this morning's subject, a reading has been chosen from The Voice of the Silence. Kill thy desires, Lanu. Make thy vices impotent ere the first step is taken on the solemn journey. Strangle thy sins and make them dumb forever before thou dost lift one foot to mount the ladder. Silence thy thoughts and fix thy whole attention on thy master, whom yet thou dost not see, but whom thou feelest. Merge into one sense thy senses, if thou wouldst be secure against the foe. 'Tis by that sense alone, which lies concealed within the hollow of thy brain, that the steep path which leadeth to thy master may be disclosed before thy soul's dim eyes. Long and weary is the way before thee, O disciple. One single thought about the past that thou hast left behind will drag thee down, and thou wilt have to start the climb anew. Kill in thyself all memory of past experiences. Look not behind, or thou art lost. Do not believe that lust can ever be killed out if gratified or satiated, for this is an abomination inspired by Mara. It is by feeding vice that it expands and waxes strong, like to the worm that fattens on the blossom's heart. The rose must re-become the bud born of its parent stem before the parasite has eaten through its heart and drunk its life sap. The golden tree puts forth its jewel buds before its trunk is withered by the storm. The pupil must regain the child state he has lost ere the first sound can fall upon his ear. Our title for this morning is Memory, Friend or Foe?
Well, when we hear these words from the Voice of the Silence, we think, why would we want to do that? Well, it explains why. Because we are concentrated on our desires and our passions, on the personal, and all these memories of what we have been are available to us. And if we live in that passion and in that desire, those memories come back and they become stronger. But but after reading that, we think, well, gee, everybody's here. Everybody that's here is here. And they had to remember how to get dressed this morning. They had to remember to have breakfast. They had to remember what they were going to do, what we were going to do. We not only did all those preliminary preparations, but we found our way here. Why here? Well, there's a memory associated with being here. So we come back to that. And sometimes that becomes a habit after much practice and much repetition. We are the sum total of all our memories. We are right here and now the sum total of all of our memories. The universe is the sum total of all that it was. That's what it is. That's who we are. This body we have, it's but a repetition of a body that we possessed before. This planet we live on is but a repetition of a body that we lived on before. Everything is on a continuum. Everything is moving forward. And we know from this philosophy that he says there's this great law of cycles. Memories. Memories. We are the sum total of that, but we are not that. We are more than that. We are the center of our universe. So what is it about memory that holds us back? Well, it's simply the fact that there is only one reality, and it's now. It's this very moment. And in this very moment, we can create a new universe, a new world, a new me. Only in the present can anything be done. The past is what has been, and we carry that with us. But we can't live there. We're not creating. We're just enjoying or suffering from the past. And we can't live in the future. How can we? Well, everything will be all right tomorrow. Everything's great. No, we can't do that. We have to live in the moment so that we create the future. Sure, we can, through a logical, systematic way of looking and watching ourselves, as we find ourselves now, we see how we are moving forward and what could possibly be if we continue thinking like we do or acting like we do. Everything is a repetition. Everything. So, but we remember, every day we remember who we are. We remember it every day. Hey, I'm here again. I'm here again. And I know who I am. Do I really? But we know we have a sense of identity that is continuing. It isn't broken up into pieces. Well, this memory is of the soul. The soul has this memory. But it's stated in many of the writings that every thought, word, action is not lost. It becomes part of the scandic thoughts of each human being, of each individual. We have skandhas, or influences, or bundles of impressions. Now, those are, you know, our body or a group of these skandhas, our thoughts are groups of these skandhas, our perception, how we see things, what we see, our consciousness are these skandhas. What is our consciousness? How do we understand it? What are we conscious of? Action, of course, is a skandha, because we know for every action there's a opposite and equal reaction. We know that. And then knowledge is a skandha as well. The knowledge that we acquire. But it's not so much the knowledge itself. It is a process by which we gather it. We don't come here into this classroom and lecture and say, this is what we have, and this is what we need to do, and this, no. We up here cannot tell you anything. We can only hope to remind you of who you are and what you are. Just a reminder, because we all know who we are. But we don't want to look at it. We don't want to take responsibility for it. We don't want to see the eternal nature of this perceiver. Now, you know, the skandhas are there, but every memory is not, memories are not in the brain. The brain is simply the receiver and the conveyor of these memories. They are not stored in the brain. They are but reflections from the astral light into those receptors and conveyors. How we get flashes. Well, sometimes we remember like outright something, but not all the details of it. That happens a lot. And then there's also other times when we see something or we hear something or we smell something, and that makes us stop and think. And then we start to recollect all these ideas or all these impressions that we've had before. Well, this is all a process of the lower mind. That passional part of our nature. It is full of impressions. It's full of impressions. You know, we have a heart, we have a liver, we have a kidneys, they all have a memory. They all have a memory. Everything has consciousness, has a memory. The idea that there are different aspects of the mind, thought, will, feeling, imagination, and memory. Now, from the time we were born, we have been receiving impressions. Impressions. And that's why many of the ancient cultures consider those years as very, very significant. During the pregnancy of the mother, statues and beautiful music and beauty was tried to surround this goddess of the world, of Mother Earth, to bring forth a being of a higher quality. So, all those impressions of a childhood are embedded within us. And hopefully we've had a very loving, kind, and harmonious childhood. But there are for many, they have not those kinds of childhoods or beginnings. And those impressions are embedded within that lower nature, within that lower mind. And oftentimes we carry them around and our perception is altered by those early impressions. So this is a skanda or a quality or an attribute. You know, that we are a generator of great force through the brain. And it's also dynamic in the sense that it can receive and convey these memory impressions. However, if there's a person with a mental problem, an injury, and they do not, or the receptors and conveyors aren't working, so they have no memory. But just because they have no memory doesn't mean that there's no stars and sun in the sky. Once, if those perceptors, oftentimes when people are in comas or in sickness, they're saying things. And how could they possibly remember that? But there's instances of people who recall aspects of that fever, of that, what was going on during that time. However, memory isn't solely a dynamic of the lower mind. There is an aspect of us which helps us identify ourselves every morning, every day, even while we're talking and acting. It's a personal, it's a sense of I. It's a reminiscence of who we truly are. And the problem that we have, as stated in the reading, is that we're, because of the age and the time in which we live, those passions and desires are at their full development. We have to take into possession those feelings and those desires. And we have to tame them so that we can use them and not use us. Because this aspect of us, this memory, if it's freed, it will again blossom. But there has to be a change in our perception, a change in our consciousness, a change in our action, and with that, a change in our knowledge. And this is why we, as a sangha or an association, keep these ideas alive to remind our fellow man, our brothers and sisters, of our true nature. That we are the creators of the universe. We don't want to consider that, because with that comes a great deal of responsibility. And we are responsible for the world in which we live. Because, well, I'm sure that we are so sensitive to what is going on in the world that many can't watch television, can't grasp the magnitude of the death and suffering that we have inflicted upon the world. And this we are responsible for. We may say, well, I don't carry those ideas. No, maybe we don't carry them right now. But we are in it because we have some responsibility in it. Whatever it may be, I cannot tell you, well, you shouldn't do that, or you should do this. No, I have no right to do that. When I say I mean this individuality, as no one else does. Anything that is said up here is only thus have we heard. We must bring it into our heart, so that we can understand what is said, not know what is said. We have to understand what is said. We have to understand that this consciousness that wells up within us is in all of life, just to a different degree. And that is our unity. That is the brotherhood of humanity. That is universal brotherhood. That this consciousness is everywhere and in everything. And what we see is simply a repetition of what was. So we don't like what we are, or we're not satisfied with what we are, or we see ourselves as what we are and say, maybe we can do better. And we look at that and then let it go. Look at it. But look at it. By going through life and not being in the moment, we need to reflect on what was so that we can alter what will be. Now, we are not perfect, and we're not here for our perfectness. We're here for our perfectibility, but we're here for our faults, our shortcomings. Those things, those memories of who we were, and probably very selfish. Very selfish. We know we were selfish because we're still selfish now. Otherwise, many of us don't see ourselves as surviving in this world if we're not a little bit selfish. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with who we are, but we have to admit who we are. And those memories, those ideas, those impressions we get from the past. We always loved reading stories to children. These myths of the giants, these one-eyed giants, and these little people, and these great adventures of Ulysses or Arjuna. But simply stated, these are memories. These are but memories. And it's said in the philosophy that nothing that can enter the imagination or the mind cannot have been. It was before. And it will be again. So memory is our friend. But when we are caught up in the sensations, the lust, the drama of life, we lose our memory, not of the lower self, but of our higher nature, that reminiscence of our soul quality. It is intuition, a direct perception of the truth of the past, but a knowing for oneself, because it is embedded within all of us. So what is our problem? Well, as the voice of the silence so eloquently stated, what do we think is real? These passions, these desires, these feelings, this daily turmoil and tumult of life? Or is it something other than that? It's only what we think it is, or what we have heard in the past that it is, that we accept as being real. We only do what others have done before. But as thinking human beings, we are given the opportunity, right here and now, to change that thinking. And we can't change anyone else. We can only change ourselves. And that influence may be enough to change others. But we're only responsible for ourselves. And if that responsibility expands, you are truly blessed. Well, I'm sure there's questions, or maybe we've forgotten something.
We were thinking we're warned not to get lost in the past. We have a memory come up, a situation we remember, and we sort of get lost in it and maybe embellish it. But then we're also told the only way to progress is to examine what you did each minute of that day and how you can change it and make it better the next day. So what's the difference, if there is one, and how do we express that?
Well, it's very important that we examine our life. Without a doubt. But when we examine our day, we look at it in an impersonal way, it takes a development to become detached from the personality. And we look at it honestly. We try to do it honestly, but it's not always easy because we don't know our shortcomings. But we look at our day, we examine it, and we, in our own mind's eye, we decide if there would have been a better way of doing it or if it would have been more helpful another way. And we examine it. And then we go, well, I'm going to put that down and I'm going to try to remember this lesson that I learned today. And put it down and move on and stay in the moment. But you recognize something. So to recognize something, therefore you have to use it. You have to be vigilant with that because you were given a gift and you were wise enough to see it. But as far as the past, you know, many people, their lives are so filled with pain and suffering, they don't want to be in the present. They don't want to be there. They'd rather stay in the past. They don't like what they see in the world. They can't identify with it. So in that case, it sort of handicaps us. You know, because we need to be present so that when something does happen, you're present with it. You don't say, oh, 2 hours later, oh gosh, I had an opportunity to do something or say something or be something. And that's okay, but you have to bring it forward. You have to bring it forward into the moment. That is the task of life in the very back.
We think there's such a big difference between reviewing something, standing objectively and looking at something from a higher position, and relishing or revisiting a memory and getting lost within it. If our purpose is to learn, we should only look at past memories as something we learned from them.
Yes. Well, we think that class reunions are a good example of of how we have a propensity to go back and to see what we were and look at everybody else and see what they've become. But it is not productive time. It is not productive. Only if it makes you closer in sympathy with those around you. And so we can identify with life. And not see the outward coating, but feel the heart of someone else. You had a question?
The statement was made that we are the sum total of our memories, or everything we've been or gone through. And we wonder if that would depend on what we mean by we, because if we're referring to the personality that's obvious to us and everyone else, the physical features, couldn't be the sum total. It could only be a partial expression of everything we are. So isn't the memory a friend if it can help us remember the larger part of our nature?
Well, yes, that is, the personality will always try to snatch away our attention, always will try to, and it will always try to place it on that small individual self, that selfish little thing that we have developed to such a state where we've survived to this far, and we wonder, well, do I really have to act that way to survive in this world? And then we realize, well, there's a bigger picture. There's a bigger, not just simply this one life, but we are an eternal pilgrim. Eternal pilgrim. So we're the sum total of all those lives. And certainly not in a short lifespan of 80, 90 years can we display all those impressions that we have had in this life. Because those transmitters and conveyors are constantly changing. They're in a state of motion in the brain. So we need to look at the larger aspect of life. And get our nose out of the particular and try to stand in the universal. Yes.
Well, we've heard so far a lot about reflecting on what we've done and sorry, reflecting through our day, and by doing so, we assimilate what we've learned, the lessons from what's been going on through the day, and if we do that consistently through a lifetime, we assimilate it where? Well, we assimilate it, we're told, in the inner core of our being, in the immortal soul assimilates all of the higher aspirations and higher thoughts that we experience. And so the philosophy tells us that literally the substance of our higher self, the substance of it is made up of our past experiences that were worthy of being assimilated into the higher self. And our higher self, in terms of Buddhi, is, you know, the storehouse of all of the wisdom accumulated through all of our lives. So this storehouse, what's the, you know, it almost seems like it's a storehouse of memories, but there's a difference between what's accumulated in our higher nature as the result of our experiences, as opposed to these flittering memories. Could we call that just higher memories, or?
Well, we could call those attributes, qualities within our nature of a higher universal aspect. But most of our assimilation, if we are mindful, we do it every day. If we are not mindful, we do it in Devakan or after death. We assimilate all of that. So the wise ones have told us that if we assimilate all of our life experience during life, our rest will not be that long. We will come back and take up the burden once more to help humanity, the poor, suffering orphan. And you know, the memory of all that we have experienced is only accessed when we truly abandon all those thoughts and deeds of the personal nature. When that is done, the mind becomes porous to the dictates of the soul. And this is all spiritual knowledge. And by, not so much by telling what people, what spiritual knowledge is, it's by living it, living the life of a spiritual being. Now, to do that, we all have to reinvent ourselves, because we're all material beings, and we live in a material world with certain laws and certain things that we need to do. So it becomes an opportunity to create something different. But when you know, when something else is different, there's a great deal of resistance. So we are told that by us sitting here talking about this, by us trying to understand it, that by many, we would seem as nothing for even considering these ideas of having any merit or any bearing on who we are. The only thing that exists is not this physical plane. Behind it exists that plane of form, and that plane of ideas and archetypes, that plane of electromagnetic energy, that is the pattern upon which this physical form is created. But it's not physical in the sense of for us. So it's the same as the thoughts we have. They're not physical, but they are. Our will, well, it's not physical, but it is. It's our desires drive the will. So that we need to refine what it is that we're in love with. Are we in love with this body? Are we in love with this life? Or are we in love with all of life? Are we engaged in life as a human being, not as a visitor from another planet? I mean, it's our attitude. It's the knowledge that we can assimilate into our very being. We're here for that reason. We want to know the truth. We all want to know the truth so that we can live our lives according to the truth. But it has to be self-realized. Again, it's not something that can be given to us. Yes.
Suppose we own a very large warehouse, and periodically we take an inventory. Can we say that in some cases we didn't know some of the things we had accumulated over time? Nevertheless, are they not a sum total of what we own?
There's a sum total of what we are right now. But to go back and look at, back into our past, and the only meaning that it would have is if we said to ourselves, okay, I understand that. And we more than likely have assimilated that into our being already. So oftentimes, it's like a fantasy we have. Let me go back and think about mom and dad. Let me go back and think about when I grew up, you know, with the chickens and the guinea pigs and all the animals and, you know, outhouse and, you know, that free life and, you know, but it's the past. It gives us a feeling, but it takes us away from who we are. We're not the past. We may be the sum total of it, but we are creating. We are the creators. We are that God within. Now, unfortunately, many think that already, and their animal nature is controlling them. And that becomes a real problem for selfishness, greed, and suffering. In the back.
Well, since every one of us is a ray of divinity, there is no sum total. We are the totaler, and there's new things to learn, new adventures of the mind. There is no sum total of us except as a potency and a potential in any life. It was said earlier that we had to elevate our thoughts. Yes, but that's step one. If we don't go to step two, which is act on those elevated thoughts, they will just deteriorate and fall away. We will lose the active memory of them. So it's a work in progress at all times.
Yes. It's stated that our goal is to make theosophy a living power in our life. A living power. I mean, that's how all religions began, because it was a living power in the lives of those who came together. And that when they met, there was the presence of something that was there. Well, it was the one life, the unity. Yes.
We were wondering that if all this experience, we are sum total, or that sum total is keep evolving from everything we've been, why isn't it appropriate for us to try to remember our past lives? If we are that sum total, why should
Well, why do you want to know what you were in the past? Do you know who you are now? That's the questions that we need to ask ourselves. Is it a fantasy? Maybe I was an emperor. Maybe I was a great king. Maybe I was a good lawyer. Does it make a difference what we've been in that sense? No, I think what has happened is that past life regression is it is not necessary. And it is sort of like a fantasy, like phenomenon, looking for the door into our collective consciousness. But to go back and to regress into past lives, adept doesn't regress, he's just aware of all that he has been, those that have perfected themselves. But for us, it's amusement. You know, what we've been, sure, we've been many things, many things. But it's not so much what we've been, it's what we are and what we can become. And we're always given the idea that there are those perfected beings who stand over and watch infant humanity and guide and instruct us. And that this movement is but an expression of those ideas. And that the highest that we can fill our mind with is presented here. But it is not here that it resides. It has to reside in our own heart. These ideas are here and preserved. This is the great Library of Philadelphia, where the truth can be found if you are strong enough to bear it.
If we take the case of a genius or a particular talent we discover we have, that has to be a wake-up call, that was learned in another period. We brought that tendency back and now we can perfect it. And it's a great analogy for whatever we have arrived with this time, we didn't finish up last time. So we need to raise it all up, whether it was something in the past or something in the present. That's our job.
Well, the word genius is very interesting because we would consider, not the we personal, but the we universal, is that, well, I forgot my thought for a second here. I was making a personal comment and then I lost my mind. just reiterate, just,
genius.
What?
Genius.
Oh yes, genius. And that is rather an abnormal development of the human consciousness. We know how we are. We concentrate on one field or one plane of operation. And if we have done this and we have been totally engrossed in it and our whole being has been encompassed by it, we carry it into our next life or our next. But we are told that this is only a partial development of who we are, this genius. The genius is a Mahatma. The genius is a perfected being. Because they're not, if you've known a genius, you know, they're very lopsided. They have great minds, but maybe no social understanding. Maybe not know how to talk to people. You know, they're off in their own world. Well, we need to develop our whole nature. And that's as sentient beings, as human beings, as loving beings. We have to cultivate in our hearts a love for each other. And we have to be aware or beware of those mental deposits or those mental attitudes that we are separate. Because in there lies our problem. When our heart has untied that knot of separateness, we can be free. But the mind has to let it go in the back.
One of the things we think we learn very gradually is that so much of what we think of as maybe our talents or our skills are dependent on a certain pitch of the physical or astral body. So age and illness can take those things away. And it's a way of proving to ourselves that I haven't changed. My ability to express has been altered because of illness or age. So we learn the difference between the individuality and the personality and why we should never judge anybody else, because their genius, their capacity for expression is still there. They just can't show it.
Yeah, and that was the point that was made by one of the articles, is that all of life has that opportunity. All of life exhibits that consciousness, from the highest Mahatmas to the lowest, in this system in which we live.
Follow up on genius. If we had an individual then who did pursue a specific line throughout many lives, but at the same time did it with the right motive, to the best of their ability, properly, it would seem that in this life, for example, that genius did flower, that they would not necessarily be lopsided. They would also bring back the memory and the character of the motive, the reason they did that as well.
Well, the motive is the guiding force of our life, our motive. And when something is stated, there are many colors of the rainbow. There are many different aspects of life, so that the possibility is endless. If our motive is one of a universal kindness, love, and is done for others, that is the motive, to bring cheer and light and love into the world. There's been many geniuses like that, but they're not honored in our world. They're not honored. If you can make money at it, then you're put up on a pedestal. But that's just the age in which we live. It is around us, but that doesn't mean that's how we are. We choose how we are. So, you know, genius is it can be a gift to humanity. In fact, you look at much suffering has been alleviated in the world through inventions, through genius in medicine and science, you know, and the arts. You know, it has helped humanity. But we also have to look at the genius of the atom. When you look at it on one hand, it explains many things to us. But on the other end, it destroys many things to us. It's how it's used, the motive on which our knowledge is focused and for what purpose. That is life. Yes.
At the Pennsylvania Hospital Chemotherapy Center, there is a bell, a big bell. Now there are 15 or 20 cubicles of people getting chemotherapy on any given day and taking it, well, forget to ring the bell when you have finished your last treatment. And no matter how the rest of the folks feel, they clap and yell and are so happy for the one who was able to get through it and can now move forward. So it's interesting, they bring sound into it. They're just, the first time it happened, I said to the nurse, "What happened?" She said, "Someone finished." And we congratulate and celebrate that. So it's a wonderful use of the mind.
Well, how that sound runs through your very being. Because it means, the sound means something.
Well, just to finish up like that, the voice of the silence tells it that a bell of sorts is rung whenever an individual soul completes the great course of life and reaches perfection. All nature, it says,
yes.
Sounds with joyous awe, feels subdued.
Yes. Yes. You're not going to leave until it's time. Yes.
We are always impressed by phrases from the Gita and the voices of silence. And that one statement, "I never was not, nor shall I ever cease to be." Well, my sense of individuality or even of personality is a foe of that particular statement. I never was not, nor shall I ever cease to be. Isn't that something to make us think about this morning's topic?
Well, that's not only for this morning, it's for every day to think about that. That we've mentioned it several times this morning about that individuality, the personality, the universal and the particular. We are here in training to develop in ourselves a universal perspective on life and on ourselves. And not only looking at life through our eyes, but through the eyes of every other human being in the world. And to develop our Buddha nature, our compassion for life. As we do that, things will unfold. Be humble. Strong search. That we will find the answer. If we want it. In fact, the only way we'll find it is if we look. Again, a reminder that all the activities at this lodge are sustained through voluntary contributions of time, service, and money. And all are welcome to participate. Meeting adjourned.